Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out today. Nice audience. And we have a terrific afternoon reading with Clarence Major and Patricia Spears Jones, and new big books out from both of them that are retrospective, career sweeping works. And I want to let everyone know about the upcoming events first, but just for this Saturday, it's a pretty heavy duty week. We've also have Fred Moten and Nathaniel Mackey are going to be with us this week. So Saturday evening, 7 o'clock, this is off campus at the McCroskey Mattress Company, which is a wonderful loft space on Market and Goff. And Hafez Modirzadeh will be providing music that night. Beautiful, wonderful musician who teaches here at SF State. And so if you can get to that, it'll be a terrific treat. There's an article in today's SF Chronicle previewing the event. Clarence is asked to read first, and we're going to hear from him, and then we'll hear from Patricia. And after that, we'll take a little break and come back for questions from the poets. This is a new book from the University of Georgia. It's called From Now On, New and Selected Poems. It goes back to 1970. What is that? 45 years. And we were working in my class with the lexicon of the various writers, both Clarence and Patricia, Fred and Nathaniel, and taking language out of the various works that people had made. And I was... We were remarking the particularity of the words that come in, and we were looking at, I had people create bibliographies among other things, and so I thought, you know, one nice way to introduce would be to look at, you know, what the books are that went back to 1970, and so these are Clarence's words: Swallow the Lake, Private Line, Symptoms and Madness, The Cotton Club, The Syncopated Cakewalk, Inside Diameter, the France poems, Surfaces and Masks, Some Observations of a Stranger at Zuni in the Latter Part of the Century, Parking Lots, Configurations, Waiting for Sweet Betty, Myself Painting, Down and Up, and From Now On. Very happy to and honored to have Clarence Major back with us at the Poetry Center. Please welcome Clarence.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Very often, I hear people describe my poetry as visual. So I thought I might start with a brief statement that I put together on the relationship between poetry and painting. It should take just 5 minutes. Would you like to hear it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, you know, it's just my way of preface, since maybe there is some truth in the notion that my poetry is visual. Poets almost inevitably reflect painterly ideas and ideals, methods and processes in their work. Painters, too, almost inevitably reflect principles of poetry, metaphor, narrative, symbolism. In a conference at the University of Washington in St. Louis in 1997 on the relationship between poetry and painting, Derek Walcott said, "When we look at paintings that do not attempt to mimic the page but makes something more than just calligraphy, there is an echo that goes with that painting." He's also a painter. "The echo that need not be the linear representation of an idea, like a piece of prose or fiction painted, or even a poem painted, but some other echo that is created. Poem painted like Kenneth Patchen's painted poems. Some of you may know those. This observation is related to what Rilke pointed, a point Rilke made in Letters to Cezanne, when he said, in effect, that a great painting looks back at you with a life of its own. It does not have to have sound or smell, but through a kind of echo, of the senses, all of them, that is, all of the senses, it speaks with its own life. Our memory of what we see, what we've seen, heard, smelled, tasted, and felt is actively involved in looking at a painting, just as those same senses are actively involved in understanding a poem we hear read or we read on the page silently. The South African writer Breyten Breytenbach, at the same conference, makes a somewhat similar point about painting when he says, in the painting, there are echoes, created allusions, references, and repetitions, and these go into creating a sense of movement, moving forward, of changing what one sees becomes something else. There's something else behind it. It unleashes a certain movement, this pattern making, this repetition. In several letters, Van Gogh says he sees no difference between literature and painting. That's a long story. He was a very writerly painter and a very painterly writer, writer of letters. He spent as much time writing and reading as he did painting. He read poetry and he read fiction. And he thought long and hard about both in relation to painting. Camille Pissarro also wrote many letters to one of his sons. However, there was no conscious effort to explore the relationship between painting and poetry, but he certainly implied it often in what he said about the act of painting. For example, when painting, he said to his son, do not define too closely the outlines. One is reminded of how poetry works. Allusion, metaphor, simile, etc. These tropes are avenues to not defining too closely. Pissarro also says something poets have always instinctively followed when he said, don't proceed according to rules and principles, but paint what you observe and feel. Paint generously and unhesitatingly, for it is best not to lose the first impression. The great poets have always mastered the rules, then gone beyond them. We would not have Walt Whitman as we know him had he not broken all the rules of writing poetry. Whitman opened up the line and created a new kind of poetry, big as America. Paul Valéry's description of the modern dance, when refocused, also might well serve as a description of the essence of painting or poetry. The same limbs deconstructing, and reconstructing shapes or movements responding to equal or harmonic intervals form an ornament of duration, just as the repetition of motifs in space or their symmetry forms the ornament of extant. Valéry wrote this in 1938 while reflecting on a painting of a ballet dancer by Degas. Finally, there are many ways in which painting and poetry are alike, but there has to be at least a few ways in which they are not alike. Hold on. Throat's getting dry. In which they are not alike. In Notes on Painting and Awareness, Louis Labrocki says, the human body is a constantly recurring theme of both poet and painter, but their own two arts, each of whole continent of consciousness, do not touch directly at any point. They have no common bridge other than their shared state of aesthetic awareness. But there are problems with this observation. Labrocki goes too far. Poetry, after all, like painting, is about process and discovery. Labrocki later in the same essay makes the point very well and does so without any conscious contradiction. Discoveries are made such as they are while painting. the painting itself dictates this process, the poet's experience, this precisely the poet's experience as well. Still, although he has a difficult time outlining them, Labraki senses some differences between the making of poetry and the making of paintings. The main way they are not alike is this. Painting is primarily spatial, and poetry is primarily temporal and conceptual. They can, however, be seen as parallel activities. But ultimately, words in a poem are not going to achieve the same effect on our senses as paint strokes on a canvas. By the same token, paint strokes on a canvas cannot add up to the kind of impression we get from words in a poem. There are limits and there are boundaries boundaries set by the nature of the forms. So that's just a little brief statement. The first poem is called Bride Stripped Bare, and it's based on a sculpture, which is actually a window frame about the size of that window there, metal and glass by Duchamp. And my poem is called Bride Stripped Bare. Duchamp's sculpture is Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors, Even, and The Large Glass. Now, I should give you a little background on this sculpture. It was shipped to an exhibition, and the glass, on the way back to France, the glass broke. And, you know, sometimes when you've seen car glass break, it fractures, and a lot of spider webs looking kinds of structures kind of spread out through it. Well, that's what happened. And when he got it back, he said, "Wow, that's beautiful. That's what I needed." So it was perfect. It was a perfect thing. It was kind of a happy accident. This sculpture, by the way, is in Philadelphia, at the Philadelphia Museum. And it's actually about the size of one of those frames there, I think. Okay. When in transit the window glass broke, she shook and came down from her wire web hammock to make sure none of her men had had a stroke. She stopped spastic before them and suspended animation. Took a deep breath, 10 men at a door in motionlessness, bachelors all, largely asleep, extended above what otherwise might have been a real bed or an ocean. This is a question mark. In an outfield, but not exactly, more like a fertile coastal area. That's the spot, lowland rising to a forest plateau. There I crouched in this outfield, seeing only the contour of his body hanging over a tree limb in the shape of a question mark. His sadness, his happiness, whatever he was, all the unknown, possibly unknowable, parts blended and long since having left his flesh like a stream of smoke, leaving a burning car, long gone out on their own, by now high above pines, mixing with factory smoke. This is in my own language. We can't cut this timber. The convicts with dreams of freedom gave it all they had. They couldn't cut it. Little corrals run all along here, no longer used, cove covered, and also gone the river running through here, fished by folk from Mono Lake, and mining gone too. But we can mine meaning, and that action stands up pretty well, like black roots around a tree planted incorrectly, a posse fought hard here, bullets flying everywhere, even knocking down an occasional orange from a tree in the long row of orange trees in the iron Santa Cruz sunlight. It's a tight situation. I move things around to make rock and tree, water and land connect in their own language, but only as I learn to speak it. Art. The glasses are clear, but how clear is the vision? If art is an absolute and a jealous mistress, then who is responsible for this juvenile ambition? Her little fat feet twitch, her little fat hands, they sweat. Save for the view of the ocean, the gathering clouds waving, the sheep going down for water, the moss on the rocks, the toy sailboat in the nook. Art could be somewhere else. Perhaps late in the day, after a snowstorm, at the edge of the city, where the last train before dark is pulling out. It's an absolute moment, but no one is jealous of it. And kindly, with her fat hand, and the little girl waves from the train window, her glasses fogging up. Coffee shop. She sees me, a stranger, coming in a town where everybody knows everybody else. And she pauses in mid-step, holding a coffee cup in one hand and a steaming coffee pot in the other. Her mouth opens slightly, as if she is about to ask me something, but she does not. Instead, her face relaxes with a half smile, waiting for me to do or to say what? I don't know. Because all of her understands that is really clear from my confident stride toward her, clear from the look in my eyes, in themselves, question marks, that it is my turn, as though I owe her an explanation. And I am sure I do, in this town, or feel that I do. This is an older poem. Older than those. Waiter in a California Vietnamese restaurant. With the smell of firebombing still in his nose, he brings our plates to the table, pausing for a vertiginous instant, holding them as though they are two stones. When he tries to smile, his face turns purple like the sky above that Red River Delta. He once stood against a tree with both arms above his head, like somebody about to dance flamingo, but he wasn't. It was the time of the spring offensive, and he was looking into the barrel of a rifle held by a boy whose trigger finger had turned to stone. Okay, this is wolf. Like wolf, wolf, that kind of wolf. The commuter drifts in and docks. Hundreds of peasant farmers disembark. Now they're crowding into the cathedral on their dusty knees with praying hands. They pray for an end to the fighting, the mental fungus of unspeakable things. Up in the hills, a revolutionary gazes into his pocket mirror, admiring himself. Yet at times the city seems normal. Someone flushes a toilet. Someone takes out the garbage. For no known reason, a dress in a closet falls from a hanger. A mother, again, shows off the trophy her son won in high school. The commuter to the safe island leaves without you. Watching it go, you listen to the gunfire in the hills. This little poem is based on a painting by Thomas Eakins called Will Schuster and Black Man Shooting, 1876. It goes by very quickly, so it can go by before you notice it. So be careful. Case of the elusive bird, no matter the pushing and shooting skill. Jerome said, very good, to the 33 to 76. So Tom went for the kill, the fix dead on. That moment of silence before the explosion. Sharp interest as the marsh bird falls. Territorial claims. One of my favorite. While walking a narrow path above Boulder, looking for a place to rest, I paused at a large rock alongside a diverging path and saw standing on a rock with grays and greens, the same as her own colors, a pregnant lizard, a skink, standing high, careful to keep her belly lifted from the perch, the hot surface while she, wary of trouble, watched me coolly calculating my next move, determined to protect her inner bubble, brave enough to go to war with me if necessary. So I moved off the path far from her, making a large circle, including it up, concluding it up beyond her rock, and again took up my search for a place I could claim my own. This is my one and only 9/11 poem. I guess everybody has to have one. It's called East Lansing, Michigan, September 10th, the day before. There was no warning. Rising from his rest, the dog bit the man's leg, did it quietly, then returned to his spot on the front lawn to rest. A solitary taproot grows into a green bush on which years later a girl one day hangs a wet bra to dry. But the next morning, the dog's owner came into the man's room carrying a tray containing croissants and a pot of coffee and said, quick, turn on the TV. Airplanes are flying into the World Trade Center. And the man knew then that as fast as he would ever recover from one season or reason, there would be no warning from where the dog or the airplane would come. As fast as one plant dies and another grows, the man is now a seedling, just starting from the roots of 9/11 to grow again. But into what? I'm watching the time, but you let me know. Okay. Subject for a ballot, as in ballot. Subject for a ballot. It starts in the middle of a sentence with the word or. Or many years later, you say, so that's why she said what she said, or you may never know because she died without telling you. Then again, she may have put it in a letter or better told someone else, anyone who might die before telling you. Very able, but who could forget her barley whiskey breath? Always embarrassed there by our arguments at the table, broom or no broom, she had real class. Always she left the room, or at least she left her chair. You could find her in the kitchen always, scrubbing grit or polishing a glass. That doesn't pretend to be a ballot, but it's a subject for a ballot. This is the red bench. Pier stretches out a quarter mile into ocean. At its end, this red bench, gloriously illuminated as if to speak of its purpose. I sit down. Big morning sky clear, and I'm small, grateful, and grounded. Yellow oil shimmers on ocean's hypnotic surface, close-cropped morning presenting itself as expansive, a slithering profusion, more than yellow, yellow-orange, yellow-blue, purple too, you know, below a gleaming calmness. I invite it in where color is needed. Tides pound shore, leaving spray standing in mid-air, eye level. Something overturned, I feel it. Something finished, something returning to where it started, to start again. This is Down and Up, which is also the title that Steve mentioned of one of the books. Part one, it's in two parts. Part one, Descending a Staircase. Once up, nude or not, they tend to come down, gravity notwithstanding. With or without understanding, they come down. Woman carrying a lantern comes down slowly, inspecting the dark. A woman fresh from her bath comes down, damp and refreshed. Somebody's niece or wife in a chemise stands up and walks down the steps, each one squeaking under her weight. Two guards bring down an old woman seated in a chair. Two boys carry a woman asleep in her bed down slowly for the sake of art. Another woman nursing her baby comes down. A man descends while reading a book about sin and redemption. They all come down, 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 where everybody else is waiting to ascend. Number two, the unascended staircase. No one is going up yet. The Calvinist minister must first finish her sermon. The old woman with one shoe must stand up. The man refinishing antique furniture will try his luck when he finishes. The bejeweled wealthy woman may be too heavy for the staircase. She stands on the landing, inspecting the first step for its sturdiness. Here is a young woman, a pimple on the tip of her nose, skeptical eyes, tight lips, dimples, and fat cheeks. She's waiting for her intended. They are intent on moving one way or two ways. This is No One Goes to Paris in August. But we did. And the streets were pretty empty. Montparnasse August, with a view of the cemetery, a yard of bones, we wake to it, closed curtains to it, wake to its lanes, rows of coffin stones in varying light, walking here, late with shadow, low, low, long, we're passing through, just, excuse me, just passing through neat aisles of gray mausoleums. From Paris, send this postcard, this one, calm water lilies, nothing colorless, it's morning, Baudelaire's tomb, tree limbs casting shadows west, this, a lot of time under looming sky. Nobody has time like this, time to go to Le Mandarin for coffee every day. We're not complaining. They bring the milk separate, watch the passersby on Saint-Germain. Nothing to ponder, this is the plight. Pause of Charles Pigeon in bed with his wife, both fully dressed. Pink flowers, just beneath Boulevard's name. When she lived two doors down, west, south in August, went south in August, All of us smell of heat all the time. We are the living. Oh dear, there are the dead ones there. Their thoughts more familiar, though. Lives finished nearly clear, and they make it possible for us to go on living as we do in their blue shadow. Well, I think I read for about a half hour. Did I? Huh?
One more?
Okay. Steve told me the program is an hour, so, you know, want to be fair. And I'm dying to hear Patricia. This is the last poem. This is Father. I was there looking for the house where my father died. An old neighborhood, clean and orderly, with flower gardens flanking each front door, windows covered with white lace behind which nobody seemed to live. Thanks to the restless cloudy sky, a gray light hung over it all. Despite the road sweeper's efforts to smooth it over, the main road was unpaved and bore carriage tracks and car tracks. And when I found the house at the deep end of the street, I knocked. A woman came to the door and said, "Yes, he lives here, like a character in a Gothic novel," she said. "You see, when the storm came and broke the levee, flooding the city, leaving hundreds dead, thousands stranded, beach chairs and canopies blown away, your father was the hero. He got everyone out." I knew it was a lie, but it was what I needed to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence.